There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, hello, friends. Welcome to the Tarot Styles podcast. Today, I am thrilled. This is such a treat, such a loving yes. I can't believe I got a yes for this one. I'm interviewing an incredible individual who has had the experience, the very unique experience of dying and living to talk about it. My goodness. His name is Peter Baldwin Pangor. His book, I listened to the whole thing in sort of one sitting, walking around, knitting, driving, the whole thing. His book is called Heaven is Beautiful: How Dying Taught Me That Death is Just the Beginning. And he died in 1980 in a climbing accident, an ice climbing accident. And he tells his story very beautifully. And I have so many questions, and our community has so many questions. So thank you for asking, and thank you for listening to this conversation. I think we could all use the inspiration and the comfort and the love and the light that Peter is about to share. At least that's my intuition about this whole thing. So I hope you enjoy the conversation and see you on the other side. Oh, I'm really nervous. I mean, I don't think I've ever spoken with somebody who's died and came back before. So I feel like, you know, I've spoken with a lot of, you know, we talked a little bit about yoga people and yoga and things like this and people that have had experiences, and I've had, you know, living experiences with all of this, but, you know, you have had the experience and then came back. So do you mind sharing a little bit? I know you share in your book, and I really want everybody listening to read your book as well, but a little bit of your spiritual connection before this happened to you?
Sure. I actually had a lot and didn't reveal it in the book. That's my next book, because it was safe. When that book came out, Near-Death Experience, it was safer to come out as a near-death experiencer than it was to come out as someone who's had spiritually transformative experiences that have been out of the norm and rather life-changing. So when I was a boy, I had my first experience of being an out-of-body experience, where I was taken by what I called my angel, because I was raised in the Christian tradition, Orthodox and Catholic, but it had no substance and no beingness that I could comprehend. It was energetic light, and it took me from my body and brought me into the void, what people call the void, which is an infinite darkness. And I was encased inside of this orb of the angelic being, this consciousness. And I had an experience with the void. I was pulled out of this bubble into the void, where I had an experience of infinity, but less than infinity, because I was still a light body, and then brought back into this orb again. And the darkness came into the orb, but it took on 1,000 different forms. It just kept changing and changing colors and shapes and sizes. And it was speaking to me the whole time telepathically, telling me that I had a deal, that I'd made a deal. And the deal was that I worked for this beingness, and I had to remember that, and then I got sent back. Ba-doom. And so my spirituality, and that was just one of several that happened before I died, and I didn't understand any of them, really. I lived inside of the energy that came with them, but I didn't understand them until after I died. And being able to look back in hindsight and say, okay, now it sort of makes sense. So my spirituality was contextualized in Roman Catholicism and Greek Orthodoxy. I even went to Catholic high school. But my spirituality was always about this transcendent being that has no name and is no thing and is everything there is.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I I want to ask you a question. And I think also, I'm so glad you're writing this next book, because a lot of the people in our yoga communities, you know, we're kind of, we haven't had this big experience. And I love how you kind of say in the book, it was when this happened to you, there wasn't, at least that you're aware of, like this near-death experience community. And I love how you said, like, I didn't have a near-death experience. I died.
I died. So sort of
seems strange. Yeah, but I similar to you, I grew up Catholic as well. And I was in love with the whole thing. And I danced growing up. And I had this plan in kindergarten that I was going to move to New York City and dance on Broadway and then be a nun. And then all my problems would be solved. And, you know, then I learned that, you know, the people of the church, you know, are flawed. And my priest was in jail and abusing people and all of these kinds of things. So, you know, I got really upset about that, but kept to this, you know, love of connection and things. And I had a similar, not like that, but similar experience of, you know, sort of colors and swirls and things around and, you know, something, how you say it much better than anybody I've ever heard, telling me I have a lot of energy and use my energy for good. And it was sort of like you said, you know, so I think you're going to help me right now, I think, but also, you know, many people with your next book and all of these things that you're doing to kind of decode these experiences that we have for our lives. And I've been trying to sort of do that within what I've done my whole life, but I think that you can really, you know, help me and help people that have had these experiences maybe ground it more in what the heck we're here to do. So is that kind of the purpose of your next book?
Yes. And yes, in a word, that is. Because prior to my near-death experience, I was a mystic. I had mystical experiences, and I had them in isolation. We all have them in isolation. They're subjective. They happen to us. Sometimes they involve other people, but it's always the experiences inside of us. And then it's ineffable. You can't really talk about it. Not because you shouldn't talk about it, but that's also true. You shouldn't talk about that kind of stuff. That's the rules, and which are wrong. You can't talk about it because no one can capture in language what the experience is of the of transformation. Mm-hmm. And so it's got this double barrier to it. One is social, you're not supposed to talk about it. And two, even if you do talk about it, how do you talk about it? Because you can't capture it. So I'm trying to help people raise their own voices to understand that this is not an uncommon experience. Actually, it's a very common experience. Mm-hmm. And most frequently, it comes to mourners, people who are grieving, and almost 50%, according to a study that came out 2 years ago at the International Association for Near-Death Studies, a consortium of university-based scientific researchers for 40 years. Anyway, one of the papers came out and said somewhere between 45 and 47% of mourners have an after-death experience. Somebody comes to them. And that is transformative. And so if there's so many of us in the population and we're all verbally repressed, if we begin to speak about it in your yoga groups, and I love the yoga community, because you can't practice yoga, not if you're really actually practicing yoga, you can't do it without developing a kind of spirituality, because it's a physicalized process of divine connection. And so most yogis I know have some level of deepened their spirituality as a result of the process of just doing the asanas and the mental focus and the breath. And I hope to be able to have individuals learn how to find other people who are like them, so we can have little conversations. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, there's this very large thing that's happening on a global scale. Medical science has been raising the dead for 60 years. And there's tens to 20 a million of us in the USA alone, let alone all over the globe. And we're from every culture and tradition, atheist to super theist and polytheistic. Everybody's involved here. And we are now talking to each other. We have social media and we're in communication, and I had no community and I was lost and alone. And I'm super glad now to find that not only is there a near-death community, But there's so many other kinds of people. There are more people who've had spiritually transformative experiences of different than NDEs mm-hmm. than people who have NDEs. We're a large group. We are a very large group.
So cool. Can you share a bit about, you know, just asking folks in our community, like, what are your questions for Peter? And everybody's like, okay, the floodgates just came through. Oh my goodness. I feel like if you do one of those, maybe you've done it like those large stadium kind of people, like you're just going to have the hands going up everywhere. But, you know, the moment of your death on that, you know, the cold, the mountain, the everything, everyone wants to know. And I know you've shared this in your book and you've shared this in videos, but what was that like? And then what did you see, you know, before? And I'd love to also share about, because I think this is so valuable for life, but the sort of life review, the hell that you experienced, this, you know, the people that you've heard and kind of going through that, but maybe before, it seems like before that, I know you also share like time is like not like this. And this happened, like, you know, like maybe a little bit just for my dumb brain, like before there seemed to be this, you know, like a no pain situation. And then boom, you were kind of there. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Yes, I'll do my best.
Thank you.
I was ice climbing and I was at the end of this, of my life. We had been fighting our way off this cliff for many hours through the night, and hypothermia got super advanced. And at the very end, I had this peace settle over me when I knew that I was going to die and there was nothing I could do about it. And then I went through the final hypothermic stages. And at the very last moment, I had fallen asleep, and I stood back up and kept pulling on the rope. And as I stood up, I had tunnel vision, which got smaller and smaller. I didn't know what it was. I'd never seen such a thing before. And then when it went to, as it was going to black, I thought to myself, I must be falling asleep again. And as I had that thought, it went to black and I did not fall asleep. I was awake and I wow. was confused and I had no more pain. And because hypothermia is kind of a pain-free process, but frostbite is not pain-free. Frostbite hurts. And I had frostbite all over my fingers. And I have all my digits, but I still have them. But it hurts. It's like fire. And so all of that fire was gone. And I wasn't exhausted anymore. I was energized and I was confused. And at that moment, as I awoken, the darkness that I watched collapsed expanded and became the void again, this very large dark space. And way far in the far distance, I don't know how to describe the distance. I talk about it in terms of the size of the cosmos. It was very, very far away. And a pinprick of light appeared, and then it rushed across this darkness toward me, filling my vision. And as it came to me, it communicated to me, I'm taking you. And I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I don't know what's going on, but I'm staying right where I am. And it took me anyway, and I had no power to stop it. It was so much more powerful than me. And it took me and enveloped me and carried me back into this wider space, this greater darkness that was illuminated. And I'm leaving out a lot of the details. I was an orb of consciousness. I was no thing. I was in a place of no thingness, and I was no thing. I was. We talk about it as energy or consciousness, but these are our words and concepts with ideas attached. And although they're approximations, they are not the same thing. And that's the same problem that everybody who has a mystical experience of any kind has, is you can't talk about it because it doesn't exist in the world of rationality and brain. So I was this entity that was myself again. I knew myself as myself. And I had no physicality at all, no brain, no body. And the darkness came to me and gathered into a place of light, like an opening of light. And as I saw it, it was the most seductive and beautiful, attractive, desirous I don't want to call it a thing because it was not a thing. Light flow, and it was pure white, but it was also simultaneously all of these other colors, and not just of the rainbow, but of the electromagnetic spectrum and broader. And it was flipping. It was both of them at the same time. I talk about it in being this and then that and this and then that, but it wasn't that. It was this. It was simultaneously fragmented in portions and packets of light and solid one light. So you asked about, and then it flowed into me. Okay, so I shall finish this part of the story. I was so attractive. I moved toward it, and it moved toward me. And I touched it with my being, I opened, and it flowed into me, and it surrounded me, and expanded me. And here's how I get to the timelessness part, because then all these things happen at once, all at the same time, and I expanded and into peace and beauty, joy, understanding, knowledge, compassion, but also the divine light was looking at me, and I could see all of my humanness the life I had just lived, and it showed me all of the dark hidden corners of myself where I had tucked away any behavior that I found shameful or abominable or guilt, gave me guilt. But it not only showed me all of myself, it showed me all of the pain that I'd given away in my life through selfish choice. Mm. And I wasn't watching it like a movie. I was inside the other person, experiencing in that moment what I as a human being had said or done to them. And I felt all of their chemical response, their biochemical response, their emotional response, their psychological response, and the horror of that compared to I was also inside myself, and I was in the simultaneousness, and I could see all of the causations, all of my emotions, my reasoning, my hurt, that I was blasting them with this pain. And that pain that I blasted them with turned out to be mine. It was karmically attached to me, and all I gave away, I accrued. And that was true about love too. It wasn't just pain. It was all the love that I gave away also accrued to me, in addition to all the love that had been given to me. But this suffering that I experienced, this judgment, but I judged myself. The divine, through the whole process, was only showing me who I had been. No judgment at all, just love. This is you. This is you. And I know this about you because I am you in this life. And that's how I was inside this other all these other people, as I experienced their pain, because the divine is them also. Mm. And when I could hear the love, is when my heart turned, when I saw the light, and my suffering had ended. And then I was inflated, but it's hard to know what came first, all at the same time.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, growing up Catholic also, and I think just in, the culture of like girls and boys. So there was no like old white guy. No old white guy.
No thingness. No gender, no body, no brain, no color, no eyes, no nose, no hair, no religion. Mm. No human construct. And one of the results of being in this situation is when I came back as a non-believer of anything that human beings create. I live in the context of it, but not politics, not religion, not words. Words are as ethereal as religion is, and religion is built on words. But the divine, so far beyond our conception, it was love and beauty, joy, understanding, knowledge, bliss, peace, paradise, awesomeness, and these are truth, and these are all fragments of its whole being, like those little parcels of light, but it's also just love, and it loves itself. It loves itself in its own being, and therefore we, as part of that being, are also eternally and perpetually beloved because we are that. beneath all these layers that we carry. There was no old white man. There was no St. Peter. There was, I guess you could say there was a gate, but there was a couple of different gates for me. Every time I passed through, so I passed out of my body into this void. I entered into this divine being that carried me, kind of like another gate, then into this higher heaven, another gate, and then into the divine, another gate, layer upon layer upon layer. And as each layer peeled back, I saw more of my true self, to the place at which I not only inflated in the mystical scholastic world, they call communion, which is also a form of union, because self is so reduced that there's almost no self-recognition left at all. But there was a tiny bit for me in the context of this much larger being that inflated me with its own being. And the more layers that peeled off of me, the more clearly I saw my true and original self isn't at all what I conceived it to be from this point of view of my humanity. I am a photon of light superpositioned with a field of photons that are the divine oneness. And I am limited and less than in my physical consciousness, but I am also the same as.
I mean, cool. It's like, geez. Wow. You know, what struck me about you telling your story when you sort of had that moment, or, you know, again, feel silly even saying anything, but like the moments of deciding to come back, and, you know, you didn't want to hurt your parents. They had been through so much, and then you come back, and then your life, I mean, even that night, it's almost like a funny movie almost. Like you finally survive, you get down, you guys get that speeding ticket, and then you end up in jail, and you get out of jail, and then you're back, you know, getting kicked out of the motel. I'm like, this is kind of, you know, wild in this way. And then you kind of go on and, you know, hitchhike your way back and have this sort of, it seems like this real shakiness of not wanting to be here, but you chose to come back here. And it seems for you, you know, that was one of my questions. It seems that lasted for like a really, really long time of, I don't want to be here. I, you know, you got married and have kids. Like, I love my wife, I love my family, but I'm also like that's cooler, that's better, but I'm also here and I love here. So how do you kind of, you know, still be here? And I know a lot of people, you know, I don't want to, and I know you're not doing this either, but, you know, I thought a risk of, you know, just talking about this, like, you know, obviously you're not romanticizing, you know, ending your life, and, you know, you're not talking about that at all. But there's this, I think maybe that's also why this isn't sort of in the conversation yet, all of that kind of, we can't talk about this stuff because we have to sort of like, here is the matrix that you said, like, is the only thing. So how did you sort of get to the other side? Because it seems like you have this big purpose-filled life, you know, being a pastor and sharing and writing another book and just taking the time to talk to me. Thank you very much. And just going after these things in this sort of small world while knowing that there's this big no thing for you and for everyone sort of on the other side. How did that kind of back to life transformation happen?
Kriya Yoga is really the driving force behind that. And cool. Centering prayer, which is comes out of Theravada Buddhism in the Catholic Church in combination, which I was exposed to back when I was at Catholic school. When I was in high school, in addition to the mystical experiences I had a psychedelic mystical experience. I took way too much LSD and I had an end of duality experience just before the teacher showed up to teach us meditation. And so not like the day before, but recently before that. And so I dove into meditation, and meditation stayed with me, centering practice. And that's how I began my reintegration. And then I stumbled into the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali and Yogananda, autobiography of a yogi, in the 26th chapter, where he talks about Kriya Yoga. And I began my Kriya practice because I was so mad. I was so mad. I didn't know how, I didn't know that I would come back to suffering. I think that's really what it came down to, is that I was in this paradise of joy that I can't even come close to saying that what it is. And it left me. So after I came back, I chose to come back, and the divine told me that can I live my life? And the voice says, you can't live your life. And off I go. And I came back pretty angry that I didn't know the fine print of the contract. And so I simultaneously had this, my anger was a hand to the face of the divine, but meanwhile, with my other hand, I was practicing Kriya and centering practice, because I couldn't do anything else. There was nothing in the world that gave me solace or satisfaction, and it was more like a pestilent child, screaming, but you got to feed me anyway. You still got to house me, but I'm going to yell at you. And it was really through the interior practice. And so I changed my whole life. I was going to go into architecture and the family business and all this kind of stuff, graduate school, and we had big plans. And I went to divinity school to study mysticism, to find my peer group. And I discovered that I had a peer group, but they were all dead. Yeah. They'd been dead for centuries, and they lived in books. And I kept it a secret. And what I found is that the more I practice meditation, I know I came back with an extra dose of we call it prana, if you want to, that's a fine word for it. This divine energy, I came back with a charmed dose of it. And so once I discovered that I had this, it made my yoga practice particularly aimed at it. And expanding it inside myself, and carving a path, and becoming aiming my channel back to the divine, so that it turns out that the I become a lens for it here. And the practice of it matters a whole lot more than the knowledge of it. All the study of it's important. It helped me integrate, my understanding. But what really helped me finally be here was the thinning of the veil from the inside through my meditative Kriya life, and extra mystical experiences that came because a deeper practice creates a more fertile garden for the plant, for the seeds to come and be grown. And I became more fertile as I practiced. And then it was before I died. I died a second time in 2015 of a heart attack. And it's a family thing. And I ran, I was in a yoga class.
Oh, no.
I left a yoga class. I'm like, geez, I'm really hot. And she like taught yoga. And I was like, God, it's way too hot in here for me. And I went outside and I had this massive heart attack. And I died in the ambulance. And it was after that, and I saw my granddaughter. My daughter had left her husband, and the granddaughter was 1 year old, and there was moral injury from Afghanistan in her marriage as a result of what happened to her husband. And so I saw my granddaughter's life without me, and I saw my granddaughter's life with me. And you know, having experienced timelessness, even though I wanted to go back, and I lived with this depression and suicidality, praying for my death every day, I also didn't take my own life. I mean, I tried to take my own life in high school. I never tried to take my own life since then. And there was a sacredness to all life that I can't, including my own. And that's not to say that I haven't, you know, put a wounded animal out of its misery, because I have. This prohibition that I returned with, that I couldn't take my own life, kept me here. And I found that integration is possible, and that it takes meditation for me in interior practice. But mostly I found that grace is what healed me. I pursue the pursuer, and as I pursue the pursuer, I find that the pursuer pursues me and has gifts for me in the Santa Claus bag that I don't even know are in there. And I get the gift that I need to integrate. And it's been an incremental thing, bit by bit by bit. It's a mystical experience of some intensity is psychologically shattering. It not only reorients a person in a new way in their life, it makes a new person. As when Jesus was talking about being born again, when I read him after my NDE, because I'm at the Catholic school, we read a gospel every year, which is weird because Catholics aren't usually allowed to read the Bible, which is one of those things. You get a workbook. But when I read him afterwards, as I came back and I had this, you know, wild new world, and I'm reading all these, I'm Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu and the Vedas, and I'm looking at Jesus, and I'm like, he sounds like a near-death experiencer, although I didn't have that term. I was like, he sounds like me. Yeah. What he's saying, I see. Mm. And I guess what I'm saying with that is that there have been mystics in the history of the world forever and ever and ever, and they come from all these different cultures, and the languages that they speak are different, and their cultural context is different, their mythology is different, their symbolism is different. But they're all talking in metaphor because they can't talk about it directly. But you can find it and live it here, right there, now. Not tomorrow, not next week, right here, right now. And the practices of going interiorly develop that heart muscle. And so that the expansion of the auric field of what we are made of gets bigger and bigger. And actually, instead of trying to manipulate the world to my own desires through intentional manifestation for the things that I want, I find that this bubble gives me everything I need when I need it. And that even when I make poor decisions, which I do, I make bad decisions too, that because I'm cultivating heaven inside me now, even the bad things that happen turn out okay, because I continue to grow in the divine presence. That's kind of a long-winded answer there.
Oh, I love it. I'm here for it. It's perfect. Yeah, I feel it's so cool to hear you talk, because, you know, again, I just feel like so many of my experiences, I've been quiet with sharing. I got into sharing yoga. My ballet teacher gave me that book, Autobiography of a Yogi. And because it's the first time in my life I saw this yoga teacher. He looked like Jack Tripper from Three's Company. He was just sitting there happy for no reason, like, you know, radiating some light. Everybody was, you know, not paying attention to him, being rude to him, and he was still happy. I'm like, I want what that guy has inside, you know? So I wanted that for myself. And then I got this second thought, which is, why don't my friends do this? Why doesn't my family do this? So then I sort of went down a similar path and saw similarly how I grew up in Catholic. I loved God. I loved the whole idea about it, but then saw how, you know, a few people can kind of mess things up. And then you go to yoga and you do the same thing. And then a few people can kind of not mess things up, but then also keep a lot of other people out. So I just started sharing yoga in this, you know, the easiest way that I knew how, the simplest language that I knew how. And that's kind of how, you know, our community built on that of, you know, share these things, support each other, use your gifts for good, like trying to explain it in, you know, the simplest language. So, you know, another sort of question for you is, there's so much familiarity in what you say, but we're all so unique. And I think you're kind of just cracking the ability for everybody else to share their story of this kind of familiarity. Because do you think that, you know, through all the people that you've shared with, that we all are basically trying to do our best to, you know, translate this divine here and use whatever, you know, like, I love the Santa Claus gift bag. Use like the special abilities that we have or the special ways to communicate it that we have. And do you kind of see that as something that you're helping with now, or something that, you know, can do some good in this world? I mean, also, I have a lot of friends in the wellness industry that do use manifesting just to get stuff and just to, you know, and it's very attractive to, you know, be in the magazines and have the book on the bestseller list and do the things and stand on the stage and do all of that and then tell other people that they can do that too. But I feel like, you know, a lot of our the stars in the wellness world could really use this, you know, Peter-no-thingness of manifesting. Yes, maybe you're here to stand on the stage and do that, and that's not the problem. But how do we stay on course with not getting lost in the sort of shiny things, or, you know, buying the next fancy thing, or, you know, the sort of fashion wellness, the fancy things, the, you know, you somehow seem to not be in that world at all and still be writing books and giving talks and doing all these things. So I feel like there's, again, I'm sorry, I'm not articulating this very well. It wasn't like a question that I thought of before, but I feel like it's really important because so many of the people like me really get stuck in looking over our shoulder and saying, well, that person's doing that. I need to kind of do that too, or have those things too, through the lens of my even spiritual pursuit, which, you know, obviously is spiritual materialism, but how do we stop it?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Selflessness and the practice of the recognition that the egoic mind itself is, I'm going to put it in Christian language, the egoic mind itself is the Satan. It's the thing that we need in order to live in the world. You can't live in the world without the egoic mind. You have to have it to survive. We've had it for hundreds of thousands of years. We build societies and tribes around this egoic self, and that we have children because we have an egoic self. But it is also the problem. And the problem is that it attaches to itself, and it's like a veil. It's like we come into the world with two doors, and we've got the door in front of us that we see out into the world, but our back is to our original door. And we don't even know it's there because the egoic mind is like, keep yourself paying attention over here because the saber-toothed tiger is going to get you. And so all as far as I can tell, all of the great singleness teachers in history, you can find them in the Upanishads and in the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita and Lao Tzu and Rumi and Hafez and Kafir and Jesus. They all teach a form of singleness, and the singleness is the solution to the problem of the many. You have the 10,000 things, and you're trying to juggle these 10,000 things in your spiritual life. But I could never juggle these 10,000 things. I don't have 10,000 arms. But I have a single eye, and I can hone my single eye. And as I hone my single eye, I can turn it around and look at the door that I came in. And the more I look at the door that I came in, the more I see that I'm not this person. See, I know that I came back with a bunch of advantages, and I didn't earn them. All right, they just happened, and one of them was it was the problem of my depression and my anger that this is not me. I know that this is not me. This has never been me. I'm living inside of this biological robot, but my real software is up in the cloud, and I'm living like a life as an app here. And so what I came back with was the knowledge that my egoic mind was not actually me. And so I went in pursuit of the dissemblance of it. I have a friend who's a famous rock star who shines light whenever she gets on stage. It's a phenomenal experience. The whole place gets in a state of illumination with her because she's carrying the illumination with her. Because even though she has this great fame, she's lost her self-attachment. Mm. And because she's lost her self-attachment, and this was a process over her life. Okay, what didn't happen yesterday? It happened over a period of time, and she grew into this. Because she steps out of the way, the light pours through her. Mm. Instead of coming through the prism and selected wavelengths that her egoic mind wants to control. Instead, the light just comes through. And so I have achievements in my life. I come from a family that likes goal orientation and achievement. And fortunately for me, I had that in my life because that has helped me understand and propel my career as an agent of light. But I know I'm going to die. I know that none of this comes with me, and that the only thing that comes with me is the love that was given to me. I didn't get it. None of the pain that was given to me, I carried none of that pain with me. The healing that I had was the healing from the pain that I gave away. All of the pain that I had, that was gone the moment I died. And so what I carried with me was love. And because of these two things in combination, the end of the false self, the dissolving of the false self, breath by breath, asana by asana, a capacity to see the light in another being increases in proportion, sort of in disproportion, because it's easier to see the light in someone else than it is to see it inside yourself. But the only reason why you see it inside someone else is because the light sees itself. And the more one is dissolving one's own egoic mind attachment, the easier it is to see the light inside the other, the easier it is to not have to worry about the Joneses, not worry about the Smiths and what they're doing down the street or around the corner, because this is all passing away. And I understand why people, it's like the Force in the Star Wars. And by the way, George Lucas was a near-death experiencer.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, right. Go figure. And, you know, you can use the Force. The Force exists. And you can use the Force for your own gain. And I'm not equating manifestation with Darth Vader. I'm just saying that don't push the metaphor too far. you can use this and manifest stuff in your life. You can. People do it. But it's here, and it's a thing, and it's temporary, and it's not my original self. It's not my higher self. And so instead of trying to manifest everything I want in my life, I instead try to just bring heaven here now to live inside me. And it turns out that it lives around me then. Well, the more it lives inside me, the more it lives around me.
Oh, that's it. For me, that's just, you know, something to hold on to, because I sort of feel that, you know, my husband, he's an ice climber too. You guys would get along. And he's had a lot of, you know, these experiences growing up doing Tai Chi and things like that in a family that did that kind of stuff. And, you know, his question was interesting because he's, you know, kind of like you also East Coast, like, you know, can think about this way. And his question to you was, and I think you just answered it, but how do you stay with that feeling of the experience and the love and the light and the, you know, using the Force? He's also a huge Star Wars fan. and not jumping out too much of the analytical mind, even questioning, you know. I love that you share in your book the day that you shared with your congregation about your experience and essentially reveal that you have no faith, but you know, so you don't need to believe in something that you haven't experienced. And I feel like it's such a good that you're writing this next book and giving just the permission to share for people to have had living experience of this. But how do people like him that have had more living experience of this and maybe not feel comfortable to share with somebody else, but how do you stick to that without getting back stuck in your head of not questioning, did that really happen, but maybe a little bit of, did that really happen, or I still have to do these things and life's so hard, or whatever it is? How do you sort of stay, because you obviously you're in that. It doesn't seem like you have, I mean, you're a person and you do things and, you know, you don't want to be worshipped as some sort of, you know, water walking person, but you seem to have this ability to at least most of the time or be kind of know your way, know the things that can bring you back in. So maybe that's, you know, a too long way to ask that question of how do you find your way away from analyzing and a way back into bringing the heaven here, using the force for good?
That's a great question, because it's the fundamental question and it's the fundamental trap of spirituality ending up in the head and belief systems overriding doctrines and dogmas and structures overriding the experience. It's really only in the experience. That's the only place that it is. And so the experience of qi, the qi ball energy, if you can, you know, gather a qi ball tomorrow, you can remember back to the qi ball. And if you reform your hands and get in a stance, you can bring that qi ball back again. But thinking about it, it's not the same thing as the doing of it. And the way that I have always, because I'm an analytical person. Like if I take tests, I'm like super analytical. That's what I systematically analytical. And but I use my brain against itself, because in some martial arts, you use the energy of the other person in order to defend yourself. And I do the same thing with my brain, which is my meditation life and my kriya and my yoga and my breath life. And I constantly come back to it. So I have had over my lifetime ritualized practices of time and practice, so that I show up when I don't want to show up, and I keep practicing and I keep carving the space. And then what happens during my daily life, I was out my bike just the other day and somebody almost didn't stop at a stop sign, almost ran the stop sign, and I was in the way. And I was like, ah! And it would have gone poorly for me. Mm-hmm. And I freaked out. I was like, what are you doing? But this person stopped and they were apologetic. But my adrenaline rush continued as I went on my ride, and which powered my thinking about that guy in that truck. And as I'm pedaling, I'm like, wait. That circumstance is over. I just go into my chant. I start to breathe with my chant wherever I am, and I follow my breath, and I bring myself back to my place of peace. Because the more you practice in a ritualized fashion, basically showing up even when it's not working, this capacity to access it grows in proportion to the practice that you put into it. And in terms of a mystical experience, an energy mystical experience where you've had some kind of transformation that happened to you, you know, out of body experience, an angel of light, being of light comes to you, or you have like this huge, super huge buzz through your body there's lots of different ways that somebody comes and visits you. They all leave a doorway. All mystical experiences leave noetic understanding inside the person. And that little tiny doorway can be contemplated, can be pondered, can be mulled, can be looked at, not to grasp the meaning. The trap is, what's the meaning? What's the meaning of this? Mm. That's a trap, because the meaning of it is actually the experience itself. The meaning of it is the meaning that we want to make. We're making meaning out of it with our brains, which is fine. It's not a bad thing, but it's not the thing itself. And so to stare at the experience, the emotion, the closest we have to the experiences that we have is the emotional response to it, which is a lot less languified. There's language, there's not a lot of a language attached to it. And so you can look at the feeling of it, the buzz of it, the warmth of it, the presence of it, and that becomes a doorway that then gets bigger and bigger and bigger as time goes on. So there's two ways. One is that my practice of my chanting is running in as a tape loop in my subconscious, constantly, so that I'm able to access it when I'm on my bike and somebody tries to run me over, and it's just easy to pull right up. Or in my meditative life, I do a lot of energy work. When I'm actually deep in my meditation, I have no language going on at all. I'm either paying attention to my physical body, or my breath, or just my breath. One of those two patterns. And so when I'm, say, for instance, in a downward dog, I'll take my mind and I'll run it down to the arches of my feet where there are energy centers, up my legs, down my spine, into my brow and crown, and down into my palms. And then I just run this pattern of my breath. That's a little more of an advanced technique that develops after one learns how to, and you probably know how to do this already because you've been doing yoga so long, how you relax muscles and you tension muscles, and you relax the muscles you're not using and you tense the muscles that you are using. And that training trains a mind to run the spine so that you can run up and down the spine, because you can then begin to feel the spine. And so a physical yoga practice builds naturally towards a subtle body practice.
Awesome. You're the yogi preacher. So cool.
So I got kicked out. I was at Yale Divinity School, and one day, this is like in 1980, geez, it must have been in like 83, and I was way down in the lower stacks doing yoga, you know, in these like library stacks where you have to turn these big wheels to move this. And I was like at the very bottom of the library, in the very back corner, and the librarian caught me and kicked me out for a week. What are you doing down here? This yoga, get out of here.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. So good. Yeah, I love it. I love leading yoga because you get to see people have those little moments. And I got to be friends with Deepak Chopra and teach him yoga, which is funny. When he asked me, I said, you don't need anybody to teach you yoga. And he said, yeah, but you're not one of those intellectual people who are going to try to impress me with everything they know about yoga. You're just going to do the yoga with me. And I'm like, well, that's all I do. So we became really good friends about that. That's what it is. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm just learning about you too, Tara. and I looked into your yoga and I thought to myself, she looks like she's just teaching yoga.
It's kind of it. I mean, I love it, but you know, I learned a lot about it, but the more I learn about it, the more I learned it doesn't. I mean, I love that you say language. To me, language in yoga is only important when it gets out of the way, when you just describe what to do and then I disappear. Like Mike, my husband's a mountain climber. And even when we started a studio, I was like, I don't really want to have, you know, a studio and like be this thing, but I want to lead yoga. And I kept using the word lead and guide. And he said, well, you know, when you go up a mountain, and I don't know anything about mountain climbing, but he used this word guide. Sometimes you go with a guide and they tell you, like, obviously, you know, like what not to do and all this stuff. I'm oversimplifying. I said, well, that's how I feel about leading yoga. You know, I've done it a bunch of times. I know it enough to take someone else through it. And so therefore, I'd rather be, at least, you know, language sucks, but I'd rather be a guide than a teacher, because once you become a teacher, and again, nothing wrong with that word, but I started teaching yoga when I was like 20 years old to like 50-year-old finance people who are like crashing the stock market. And I'm like, I don't want to be a teacher. I want to guide them maybe to not crash the stock market and to like treat their family a little bit better. And, you know, kind of just went from there. But yeah, I feel like everything you're sharing about just being in the experience is so good for me personally, but also good for sharing with others. You know, I guess that's sort of the main thing I wanted. I mean, they asked me so many questions to ask you, but it seems like you just answered them all so many different ways. But, you know, I guess one, and just come back to the practice and do it and get out of the way. You know, Tai Chi, I found a lot of more simple language in Tai Chi because it's not popular. Maybe because it's not as popular, people haven't put like weird language on it, just sort of like unweight what you're not using, use what you need, rest what you don't, move from your center. You know, this Wu Wei, I love this, you know, don't overwork anything. You know, you can't ever be great at doing it, but you can always improve and get better. And I love that. You know, I also grew up doing classical dance, and then yoga physically was, I mean, the poses are pretty easy, you know, most of them. And so I kind of figured out, like, it's not about the poses, like what you can do, what you can't do.
It's not about the poses. It is not about
how you are. Yeah, how you are in the moves. And then, yeah, that kind of was that doorway for me just to share it in a more simple way. Cause I saw a lot of people sharing yoga in a very, you know, almost rigid way. And also, like, we're rigid. It took me a long time to figure out, like, it's not like all these teachers are bad. It's that we all have this natural tendency to be like rigid, narcissistic, you know, crazy people. So we're going to like rigid ourselves in these positions. So yeah, it's been quite a journey, but fun, and just to, you know, lead the experience. But I guess that's, you know, another big question for you that seems so just silly to say, but how do you find, or how would you guide somebody, you know, in a yoga class or in your congregation, or just somebody that asks you, how do you find your purpose? If they're like, if they have a yoga practice and it's not working, or if they have it and it is working. I mean, a lot of people have these yoga practices and they do them for forever, but it's still like, is there some other like whack on the back of the head? I feel like, you know, you don't give yourself enough credit with language, because you're very good at the language. It helps how you explain everything in your book and in talking right now. Just it expands language beyond, you know, whatever, in a nice way. So you probably have some words for how do we find our purpose besides just, you know, do the practice.
I would ask, what do you want? What are you looking for? What is it? What's your, you know, in that there's a show, and I don't know what channel it's on. It might be on Netflix. It's about Lucifer. And he always asks, what's your desire? What do you desire? And they're like, that's really my question is, what do you want? If you're, what's my purpose in my life isn't my acquisition of things, although I like nice things, I do. And it's not my reaching of my goals, but I like to reach my goals. My purpose in my life is to become empty of myself, to allow the light to shine inside me, so that I can then find my way through the world as the doors open in front of me. Mm. And so my purpose I couldn't find any purpose in the world other than love and caring for people. That's it. And otherwise, it's directed right back toward my original self, which is, you know, loving and caring for people. It finds its source in the same place. Mm. So, but I understand why people want to know what to do. Like when I went through a crisis after my NDE, and I was deciding not to go into the family business and not go to graduate school in architecture, has long been planned and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and I was lost. I was like, what am I going to do with myself? And I found that by going inward, the deeper I went on the inside, the more I went there, the calmer I became about whatever was in front of me. And even in anxious times, when things are like really in turmoil, to come back to this quiet place and come back to this quiet place, this becomes the purpose of my being. It's because and I know this is hard. I'm temporarily here. My self-identity is as a Peter in this world, but my real self-identity is this energetic being that is actually me. And mm-hmm. So instead of trying to fuel myself in this world, I find that the more that I fuel myself in that world, mm-hmm. the stronger I become in this world. Wow. And so I backweight, going back to the martial arts stuff, I weight my back foot. I weight my back foot into heaven, and my right and my front foot is a lot lighter and more capable in this world as a result. And so, but what am I going to do with my life? I had this TV show for 15 years, and then the corporation purchased the corporation, and my show was canceled. And now, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do? How am I going to earn a living? And what's my purpose? Well, my purpose has been this through line all the way through. My purpose has always been to find a deeper connection to the divine. And I find that as I find the deeper connection to the divine, even if I struggle for a couple of years trying to figure out how to manifest it, because I've got a steady spot, my foot is back weighted because I have that steadiness, I'm less frightened in the world of what I'm not, because I already know who I am. Mm. And yoga can become like any ritualized practice. It can become a prison. And how do you get out of the prison of your own mind? And if you define yourself, like when people retire, they have so identified with their jobs that when they retire, they lose themselves. And then they have to try to find themselves again. That can happen in yoga. Yoga can become the whole identity, and which is fine. There's nothing wrong with this. There's no evil here. It's just that it's a limitation. But yoga can be used not uniquely, but in particular, yoga can be used to do the very thing we're talking about because it's built into the practice. Yeah. It's already there. And so if you just add breath and quiet mind and use your mind to look either at the physical body so that you're not thinking in language and breathing into those spaces, then that naturally is going to give you access to your subtle body. And then you're going to be able to find your chakras. And you don't need to know a damn thing about them. You don't need to know their colors or their names or anything because they're real. Mm-hmm. And I didn't need to know the name of my thumb when I was a year old to know that it worked. it can give you purpose in your life that transcends your ordinary life. The purpose becomes people. It becomes relationship. It becomes living with the aim toward dying. Mm. Because the practice of the loss of self is a practice of the end of self. And that's a little death. And there's this, above this monastery in Greece, there's this carving on this door jamb. And it says, if you die before you die, then when you die, you will not die. Mm. And that's what this practice is a dying to attachment to self. And so then you can end up on the biggest stage in front of the largest audience, leading the best yoga that anybody's ever taken anywhere, and still have no self and still not be concerned about, and you can pay attention to the lighting and the makeup and the clothes, and you can do all the marketing and all the promotion and all those kinds of things. But then it's not about self. It's about guiding others to find the thing you have already inside yourself so that they can find it too. And once they found it, they don't need you anymore. Mm-hmm. Because now they know that it's there. And when you were talking, that's what I heard in your talk. That's what I heard you saying.
Yeah. For me, that's been the whole thing too, it doesn't work for me how you say, like, all these practices are way back to that back door. Like, yoga doesn't work for me if I tense up. It just doesn't work. It's like, it feels awful. You know, if I took some classes with some styles when I was like 19, or I'd go to different places, and, you know, if it was like, move your shoulder here, and the teacher was saying something and I internalized it and it was too much force, too much effort, nothing worked. And I was like, that didn't work at all. You know? And I leave and I'd be like, that didn't work at all, you know? And I would go home and just do a little bit on my own of what I learned, but then relax a little bit. I'd be like, oh, that totally worked. That completely worked. So, you know, little by little, just figuring out that is, you know, the closest thing that I know to magic. And then that's always just led me personally to, you know, like, when you have this magic of, you know what it's like to die. And I feel like I have this magic of, I know how amazing you can feel and how connected you can feel to other people when you have this physical practice of yoga working. So I, you know, I kind of spend my time, you know, with this whack on the back of the head feeling of every person I see, whether they're in a yoga class or like somebody at the mailbox, like, if they're a little bit crooked and I can stand just next to them and breathe and do these things like center my chi, then mm-hmm. it has a little bit of chance to center their chi. And then, you know, I benefit because then they're in a better mood, and then they benefit because they're in a thing. And then I can kind of go around with my little secret, you know, power of doing that. And that's always been, you know, how I've, since I figured this out, you know, just move through the world. And I've seen that, you know, unlock weird doors that shouldn't be unlocked for someone like me, you know, from a small town, like doing projects with famous people and this kind of stuff. But, you know, that's what I'm trying to stay on the right path of doing. And I feel like, you know, not, I don't want to create other people to be like me. I want to help other people figure out that experience that you talk about more eloquently, so they can you know, keep that foot in the back door and do that in their life. So I think you're really on to just communicating that, first of all, in a way that's hard, because I've just been communicating it through like yoga, you know, and it's been like fine. But yoga turns a lot of people off. I mean, they're like, I can't touch my toes. And I'm like, bend your knees, it's going to be fine. And they're like, no, but I have to do it with straight legs, you know. So it sets off right. Like, you know, any Christian is like, oh, that's against Jesus. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know, they're like, yoga's not for Republicans. And I'm like, well, I don't know. But like, you know, it's a conversation starter, but it's very polarizing. So I love, you know, I love everything that you share. You know, everybody has this, everybody's going to die. We all have this in common. And I feel like it's such a wonderful way to, we have to use our language here as much as possible to do it correctly, to not mess things up. But I feel like it's such a better way to, you know, just love people and connect with people and help yourself as you're here. So I just feel like that's something awesome you're really doing. Thank you.
Well, you and I were doing the same thing. As I move through the world, I do exactly the same thing you're doing. You talked about with your chi. I and so that the whole verbalizing of my experience and the work that I've been doing since then is secondary for me to the experience of the chi itself that I share wherever I go, whatever I'm doing, any chance I get. And I'm not trying to push it into people. I'm not trying to, you know, use the force against them. I'm just trying to bring it to myself and invite them in to share if they want to. And they don't even have to know that they're invited in. I can be standing behind them in a grocery line and just drop into the space and let it happen however it happens around me, because it benefits me and it benefits the people around me. And the more of us that are out there doing that, the greater the shield, the force shield of the divine light is in the world, because we're all channeling it, not us. And that's really what it comes down to in your previous question. It's who are you channeling? Are you channeling yourself into the world, which is totally fine. There's no prohibition for that. It's just that it's not timeless or it's in that it is limited. And I'm preferring the unlimited and the timeless, and that energy is available to us. And you're dropping into your chi and using your chi in the world in a quiet way, because chi can be weaponized too. Mm-hmm. You can throw a punch with chi and you can hurt somebody. But if you're quieting yourself and just allowing the energy to be, you're influencing the world all around you. And the light sees itself. Even if, so some of my atheist friends, I have two very dear atheist friends, and they one of them calls me, he says, I have the God madness. And the other guy, he's been a friend of mine since something happened to us on the Appalachian Trail the year before I died, and he's going to be in the next book. And he's still an atheist. We still love each other, but he's also one of the most spiritual people I know, because I can see it in him. He can't even see it in himself, and that's totally fine. But I see it in him, and that's good enough for me. It doesn't matter about belief systems. It's not about belief systems. It's an energy field that makes all things exist, and it's accessible, particularly in nature. You don't see the oak tree out there trying to radiate the divine light, but you can, you know that it is when you walk by. Oh, that one's got it.
Oh my gosh, amazing. Wow. Oh, I feel like I've taken so much of your time, but I'm so grateful for everything you're sharing, and I love your book, and I'm just going to be stalking you on the internet and everything you're doing. But thank you so much for taking the time. I guess there's, you know, if you had one, you know, short sentence that somebody walked by and they just need a little something to keep going, what would you kind of whisper in their ear?
Trust your heart. And look there with intensity.
How fascinating was that? Oh, beautiful hummingbird. My goodness. Everything's a sign. My goodness. Thank you to Peter so much for sharing all of that wisdom that's come through. I hope you really felt that energy of love, of peace, of beauty, of joy. I definitely felt that just simply sitting here across from a screen, speaking with him, taking the energy. So I'm sure it was able to radiate outward in however you are listening or watching this right now. And make sure you check out a copy of his book, Heaven is Beautiful. Share it, pass it with your friends, share your experiences. That's something that I really learned from Peter, sort of had this bubbling up. It wasn't even one of my questions, but this, let's share our experiences, not just if you've had a near-death experience or dying and coming back, but your living experiences of being connected to our divineness. Share them with me, please. Share them with each other. And let's get this conversation going so we can bring this divineness here more and live our purpose. So big hugs. Feel free to come practice with us on stralahome.com, the Strala Yoga app. If you want to be there and it's tricky or tough for you, feel free to reach out. Easy. We're all here to help you. We're all here to help each other. That's such a joy for me. So thank you so much for being here. Have a wonderful day. Keep doing your practice, centering yourself. Remember, you are love. And I'll see you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.